Tired of being confused, frustrated, and even driven to distraction by today's financial markets? It's time to start thinking like a winning hedge fund manager. Your first step to this mindset is to spend the next hour with the mad hedge fund trader, John Thomas, a 40-year industry veteran and founder of the hedge fund industry. This is Hedge Fund Radio, and now your host, John Thomas.
Hello, investors in New York, London, Shanghai, Tokyo, all the ships at sea, and today Houston, Texas. This is John Thomas, the Mad Hedge Fund Trader on Hedge Fund Radio. I'm the publisher of The Diary of the Mad Hedge Fund Trader, and I'm here to show you how to invest like the traders who always come up with winners. I've been in this game for 40 years, and I'm happy to pass my tricks of the trade on to you on Hedge Fund Radio. To see the charts and research that back up my show today, please go to my website at www.madhedgefundtrader.com. My guest on Hedge Fund Radio this week is Jim Trippin of the China Stock Digest, who's going to explain to us today the mysteries of the Middle Kingdom. Jim started out his career as a CPA with Price Waterhouse, advising the pension programs of companies like Exxon and Shell Oil. He then struck out on his own to found one of the most widely read investment newsletter families in the U.S. They include ETF Profit Report, The Dividend Genius, and the top-rated China Stock Digest. Jim maintains a permanent team of financial analysts in Hong Kong, Shanghai, and Beijing, who are constantly trolling China's backwaters for investment nuggets. Jim has published two books, Stay Rich Forever, Retirement Planning Secrets of Millionaires and How They Can Work for You, and Becoming Your Own China Stock Guru, The Ultimate Investor's Guide to Profiting from China's Economic Boom. To learn more about Jim, you can visit him at his website at www.chinastockdigest.com. So, Jim, you I understand you used to work for Price Waterhouse.
That's right.
Did you ever get a chance to participate in the Academy Awards? I always wanted to escort a movie star down the red carpet.
You know, that was an honor I never got a chance to do. It's funny when you interview to work at a firm like that, and back then, of course, years ago, when I started my career 30 years ago, they used to call it the Big Eight, the eight international accounting firms that essentially controlled every publicly traded company's
stock price. Right, the Big Eight, which is now the Big Four, isn't it?
Yeah, we call them the Final Four now.
The Final Four, okay.
But, no, when you recruit for a firm like that, they always show you the glossy brochures with the young staff stepping onto the helicopter and flying out to the oil rig in the Gulf of Mexico, doing the cross-country skiing in Alaska, checking out the pipelines, or walking the gorgeous model of the day down the red carpet at the Academy Awards. But it seems like it doesn't work out that way once you actually get the job.
You know, I got the same thing from Morgan Stanley. It showed these wonderful bankers, masters of the universe, wearing Savile Row suits, flying around in private jets, which I actually ended up doing, but what they don't tell you is you have to work 18 hours a day, 7 days a week to do it.
Well, and I got to say, and you know, because I spend so much time in China, anybody who thinks that the international business is fun and exciting has never been stuck in an airport in a third world country at 4 a.m. before.
Yeah, and throw
it has
a
good point. But
throw in a coup d'etat while you're at it. I got stuck in the Seychelles once when the government fell and the mercenaries took over the airfield. So let's say now you're an individual investor. You've never invested in China before, even overseas perhaps. Give me the one-minute pitch on China. Why should I be sending my money to the other side of the world?
Well, I would say to any of your readers who don't think they're investing in China, they probably are, they just don't realize it. And the reason for that is virtually all of the Fortune 500 companies now do business in China. Anytime they go to a Kmart, Walmart, Target store, or any other shopping store of their choice, they're buying products from China, so they're supporting the Chinese economy. And the reality is that the United States is no longer going to stay the world's largest economy. In fact, it's probably going to be changing within the next 5 years to China surpassing the U.S. Some people think it's already past the U.S., but our view is it'll happen in the next 5 years. And so we think that every investor needs to be paying attention to China, profiting from China, and participating in their joining the world capitalist structure. Because if you're not, you're really missing the biggest economic opportunity of our lifetimes. China has gone from a third world starvation mode country 30 years ago to becoming the world's, depending on how you count, third or second single largest country GDP right now. And if you haven't profited from it, you're really missing out.
Well, I ran some numbers myself yesterday, and if you look in terms of new GDP created, China is already the number one economy in the world today. If you assume China's going to grow at a 10% rate this year, which is conservative, they will create $490 billion of new GDP, whereas the U.S. at a 3% rate creates only $430 billion. And financial markets go where the new growth was, not where the old growth was.
Exactly. And obviously, the Chinese have studied capitalism. It's really interesting. You know, we're talking. I'm talking to you today from Houston, Texas. I also have an office in Hong Kong and in Shanghai, but my main headquarters is in Houston. And Houston was the city that caused China to learn about capitalism. It's actually very interesting.
And how did that happen?
Well, I know that you're an old China hand yourself, and
right.
As you know, more than 30 years ago, one of the problems they had in China was mass starvation. Their economy, the state-run economy, worked so poorly, and they had overpopulated. They couldn't feed their own people. And at that time, there was a premier called Deng Xiaoping, and he was the guy who was going to be taking all the heat if they couldn't get some civil stability. And so he said, you know what, we've got to try something new. We've got to do something in order to help our people have enough to eat. And so he decided to make the move to capitalism. Now, when he did that, it was very dangerous for him personally, because at that time, the hardliners all wanted to continue to have a tight-fisted control over all financial activity, all business activity, all personal activity. And he said, tell you what, what we're going to do is we'll test it, but we're only going to test it in one city. We'll pick a little fishing village where it can't do much damage, and that was the village of Shenzhen, which is at that time maybe 30,000 in population. He said, we'll just test it there. If it doesn't work, then nobody else in the rest of the country will hear about it, but if it works, then we can start expanding it. And, you know, at that time, when they decided to test capitalism, they looked at who could teach them about it. So they remembered that when Richard Nixon opened up China to the West, along with Henry Kissinger and with, H.R. Bud Haldeman.
That was in 72.
Exactly. Well, they met Chou Enlai, and they also met Mao, was still alive back then. When Nixon went over there, the head of the CIA at that time, or one of the heads of the CIA at that time, was George Bush Sr.
I know him well. And, I talked to him when he ran the CIA out of Beijing.
Well, there you go. So, when they decided to try capitalism 7 years later, what they did is they said, hey, let's send our college kids over to the United States someplace where they can learn about it. And George Bush is from Texas. Maybe he can open it up for us. So they sent all their college kids over to Houston, Texas, and they went to the University of Houston and Rice University and Houston Baptist University and University of St. Thomas and learned about this. They learned about all this crazy stuff called capitalism, and now 30 years later, that little fishing village of 30,000 has a population of 11.8 million. It's actually larger than Hong Kong, which everybody's heard of in the United States, and not everybody's heard about Shenzhen. And 30 years later...
I spoke to my son in Shenzhen last night, and he told me that although the official population figure for Shenzhen is 7 million, the actual number is probably closer to 22 million when you account all the illegals who are immigrating in. I'm going to take a break right here, Jim. This is John Thomas, the Mad Hedge Fund Trader, reminding you that you can subscribe to my daily investment newsletter for only $179 a quarter by visiting my website at www.madhedgefundtrader.com. There you will find my last 2.5 years worth of research, which is 2/3 the length of War and Peace, for free. Hedge Fund Radio will return with my guest, Jim Trippin of the China Stock Digest, right after this break. This is John Thomas, the Mad Hedge Fund Trader, back with my guest today, Jim Trippin of the China Stock Digest. So, Jim, China's got a great long-term story, but it has dropped 30% in the last 9 months. Should I be risking my capital here? Is there a better entry point lower down? Or if I try and pick the bottom, will I miss the next big move up?
Well, that's a great question. And the answer to the question is, the way we buy stocks in China, we are finding value right now. And so we have active purchases in the China market today. You have to draw a distinction between what the China index is that trades in mainland China and what Chinese stocks trade for outside of mainland China. It's actually very interesting because inside mainland China, an investor is not allowed to open a international brokerage account, nor are they allowed, nor do they have an established options market inside mainland China. So stock prices inside mainland China trade at different valuations than the same company might trade for example, in Hong Kong or New York, very different than what we would see in an established market. Because as you know, John, if a stock traded both in London and New York, if the prices got out of kilter, someone would go in there and do arbitrage.
Yeah, they used to call that international arbitrage. It was the beginning of the international equity departments of a lot of investment banks.
Exactly. Well, but it's very difficult to do that in mainland China because these are disconnected markets. There's no options market. You can't short a stock in China. You can't get a call or issue a put on a stock in mainland China. And the investors in mainland China are blocked from the currency regulations of moving their money to Hong Kong. Now, the wealthier ones already do, but the rank-and-file investor in mainland China cannot. And so it really makes a strange combination. And so what you have in mainland China is a market that's ruled primarily by individual investors, not institutions. Most of those individual investors are not particularly sophisticated in their investing experience or history. And so it creates some odd valuations. Now, you contrast that with the types of stocks that we buy, and our metrics for picking a stock when we invest the China Stock Digest is that we use a Benjamin Graham valuation type model. And essentially what we're looking for are companies with solid growth, with solid histories, that we can buy at valuation metrics that are below typical valuations in the United States. So what that means is we're looking for forward price earnings multiples of typically less than 11, frequently down as low as 4 or 5. And because of that, what ends up happening is that we can buy into companies with substantial growth way below the typical valuation in the overall market.
Well, let me comment on a couple of things there. First of all, what percentage of Chinese trading would you guess is individuals?
Oh, I think the statistics out of mainland China are something to the neighborhood of 60 to 70% are individuals and not institutions.
And what is it here now? It's way down, isn't it?
Oh, yeah. It's almost like the inverse.
Yeah, it's more like 10 or 20.
Exactly.
Let me tell you what that means from a trading point of view. Markets with a high percentage of individual participation see a lot of buying of rallies and selling of dips. In markets dominated by institutions, you have a lot of buying of dips and selling of rallies, which means it gets really hard to make a buck in there if you're not a professional.
Right.
And I watched Japan's flip from one to the other, and as soon as that happened, the profitability went out.
So the opportunity is still there in China. And the thing of the how we approach it is that the stocks that we're buying are not, we're not buying the market indexes. First of all, what we've been able to validate and prove over the last 6 years of our research in China is that we can outperform the market indexes in mainland China and in Hong Kong with a lower risk level by using our style of investing. You're not, it's not really necessary in mainland China to go in and purchase companies at extended valuations in order to access growth. You can get the growth without it.
So you're buying stocks with PE multiples of 11 down to 5 versus a PE multiple of 13 for the S&P 500. So you seem to be buying the China value play more than the China growth play. Or are you getting both for the price of one?
We're getting both for the price of value, which is what we get really excited about.
So back to my original question, where do we bottom? Could China go down further? Am I risking a lot of money here? I mean, is it going to drop by half or something like that? Or should I, you know, just scale in from the current levels?
Well, I think you scale in from the current levels. There's no question that the Chinese ADRs, which is basically where the sandbox we play in, we buy China stocks traded in the United States, and we also buy the H shares, meaning the China stocks traded in Hong Kong. Those stocks will have a strong positive correlation to the U.S. stock market indexes. So because of that, it does not mean that if you buy in China, if there's a pullback in the United States, you're not going to be immune to it. I mean, it is just the way it goes, that you're going to have that positive correlation. And so what we're trying to do is be a stock picker and pick those specific opportunities within the overall market, and we're not as focused on what the market index directions are. That being said, you know, the markets are very volatile. There's no difference with the volatility there and the volatility here. And we've seen, you know, extreme volatility in both directions over the last several months here in the United States. That is reflected in the China stocks that trade in the United States as well.
Right. Now, I hear people complain a lot that all the numbers in China are rigged. You can't believe anything. What happens when you when your analysts show up at a company and ask for detailed financial accounts and outlooks for the future?
Well, this is where having relationships in China really come in handy, because in China it's not as open an environment as it is in the United States. Now, that being said, every Chinese stock that trades in U.S. market has to comply with U.S. disclosure rules, including Sarbanes-Oxley. So for the large blue-chip companies of China, their accounting systems and their auditing are world-class. For example, the Exxon of China is a company called PetroChina. PetroChina, which trades under the symbol PTR, has their accounting work done by the Houston Energy accountants of PricewaterhouseCoopers, the same people that I used to work with when I was in charge of running all the Exxon examinations many, many years ago.
So that's PetroChina, which is Papa Tango Romeo.
That's right. And they have widely acclaimed world-class financial reporting. I know the people who are the partners on the job that do their Sarbanes-Oxley work. I know those are quality numbers. But when you get to some of the small-cap plays, or you get to some of the micro-cap plays in mainland China, that's where you start to get into situations where it could be anybody's guess how how reliable those numbers are.
So you would recommend staying away from the small cap, micro cap area and going with the big blue chips.
That's exactly right. Now, we've occasionally, I mean, if you look at our model portfolio at China Stock Digest, our metrics are that we're large cap value players. And I would say over the last 6 years, there have maybe been three or four specific instances where we bought a small cap or a micro cap stock. But that's always a very speculative play. We disclose it as a speculative play, and it's never been our core portfolio.
And it's got to be a small weighting also.
Exactly. And for us, what we're looking for in a situation like that is we're only taking on a situation like that where we can really see a potential for a substantial return, meaning we're looking for a, you know, 3 to 5 time, you know, 3 to 5 bagger on a stock. And if we can't see that, we won't even touch it because –
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, we won't even touch it if it's less than that because we can get the returns we need with the lower risk.
Yeah, so why stretch for return?
Exactly. I mean,
with the extra risk.
That's exactly right. I mean, what we're looking to accomplish is we're trying to get the maximum amount of return with the minimum amount of risk. And so why would we want to take on an unnecessary risk? We only take on a risk if we can get paid for it. If we're not getting paid for it, we don't take the risk.
Yeah, I take that philosophy also, and which is why I don't like buying anything in the U.S. at all. I think you're taking a huge amount of risk just to buy some blue chip names which have Gucci qualities. Got to take a break here. This is John Thomas, the Mad Hedge Fund Trader. Back with my guest today in a few minutes, Jim Trippin of the China Stock Digest. This is John Thomas, the Mad Hedge Fund Trader, back with my guest today, Jim Trippin of China Stock Digest. So, Jim, I understand the Chinese made moves to allow a free float of the renminbi or the yuan recently. Does this enhance or undermine the attractiveness of Chinese stocks going forward?
Enhances it. And the reason we say that is that the stocks that we're buying when we invest in a Chinese company, generally speaking, are listed in mainland China. So any currency adjustment from a strengthening yuan or a strengthening renminbi will be to our benefit, not to our detriment. And a lot of investors right now are very concerned about what the future is for the U.S. dollar. They see what's going on with the economic policies here in the United States. They also see what's going on with the euro, and they don't really know which way to go as far as where to protect their principal. And so one great option is to look at some of these economies where there is still positive economic activity, mainland China being the one of the primary ones. And so if you looked at the current value of the renminbi, it trades. They say they're going to let it free float. We'll see if that's really true. I mean, time will tell. But if they allowed it to free float today, it would move from where it is today of roughly 6.7 renminbi to the U.S. dollar all the way down to roughly 4 renminbi to the U.S. dollar.
Yeah, I figure you'd get a very quick 50% appreciation if you did that.
Right. But, there, of course, what's going to happen is the Chinese government's not going to allow it to float that quickly.
So
it's going to take several years.
So what this means is that you're really getting a double play in China. Not only are you getting the growth of the companies and the economy, but you're also doing this in an appreciating currency, much like we saw with, say, the Australian dollar, the Canadian dollar, the Swiss franc, or even gold.
Exactly. So it's the best of both worlds.
What do you say to people like Jim Chanos who say that the real estate market in China is Dubai times 1,000, that the mother of all crashes is coming, and that China's a short?
Well, what I say to Mr. Chanos is that some people will say anything to get on CNBC, and I don't buy it for a minute. Now, if you look at the real estate market in mainland China, there is no question whatsoever that some of the real estate prices are overextended. But if the real estate prices are so overextended in China, how come they had positive GDP of almost 9% last year when we had an actual contraction in GDP? Well, the answer comes right back to Mr. Chanos's comments, and that is that when you look at real estate in mainland China, the situation is that real estate in mainland China is financed. When you go to buy that piece of property, typically you're talking about buying a condominium. And when you go to buy that, you're going to have to put down something in the neighborhood of 30 to 40% as a down payment. And because of that, when the real estate market pulls back, or even if, you know, there's a bubble and it slows down a little bit or contracts, people are not very likely to walk away from their house if they have a 30 to 40% down payment. Here in the United States, where people were buying property for no money down, 5% down, 10% down, when property values fell 30 or 40%, you couldn't stop them from scrambling fast enough to get away from their property.
Yeah, I was going to say, too bad people didn't figure that out here. I mean, it used to be the case, like 30 years ago when I bought my first house.
Exactly.
You know, my old friend at Morgan Stanley, Peter Roach, makes the argument that Chinese real estate is being driven by real demand of people coming in from the countryside, paying cash, like you say, and it doesn't have the speculative elements that were found in the U.S., U.K., and other places.
Well, when you have to put 30 to 40% down, it takes a lot of speculation out of the system. And my point about it is this, that when you have people who have that much vested capital or invested capital in a piece of property, they're likely not to go walk away from their loan, which is why China did not have to spend all their money to bail out toxic banks. They instead got to spend their economic stimulus money not doing the liberal Lollapalooza party we've had here in the United States, but instead doing direct job creation. and modernization and things that actually will make them more competitive long term.
Yeah, so no money spent on jobless benefits in China.
I'm sorry?
No money was spent on jobless benefits in China. There isn't an unemployment office in China.
No. If you want a job in China, you can find a job in China. You might argue about how much they're going to pay you,
yeah,
but you're going to find a job.
Yeah, and I think the average wage there is, it works out to about $3,000 a year.
Well, it varies widely, so the average is kind of misleading. If you are a uneducated, unskilled laborer, then you might make as little as $1,000 or $2,000 a year. If you are fluent in three languages and have a college education, it's not unusual for you to make $40,000, $50,000 a year. So,
yeah, and they're paying PhDs there $100,000 to $150,000 a year because they have to compete with the likes of Google and Cisco for the same people.
Well, probably not so much with Google anymore since they bought, booted them out of the country. But
you could replace Microsoft instead.
Exactly. No, that's true. That's absolutely true. So what I'm saying is that the stories of the China real estate bubble are way overstated. And to the extent that there is a China real estate bubble, it's going to be suffered more by the individual investors who put the cash down on the properties and less by the financial institutions, which allows the government to spend their money where it should be spent, which is creating real jobs.
Now, I'm also a big resource investor. China enters the picture every day. Do you see the demand for commodities continuing in China, or have they accumulated big stockpiles which they have to chew through before they do any new buying?
No, I think that the commodity story in mainland China is one that's just going to continue and continue to grow. If you look on each commodity, you find a slightly different story. So, for instance, when you look at oil, the Chinese have virtually no domestic, they have some, but virtually no domestic supplies of oil. And so they come out and compete with us pretty much across the board wherever they can get it. When you come to other natural resources, for example, coal, they have a 900-year supply of coal. If they can buy it cheaper overseas and not use their own, they'll buy it overseas.
I think coal is their third or fourth largest import.
Exactly, because if they can get it cheaper overseas, they do. And it's provided somewhat of a natural floor underneath the stock prices of some of the companies over the last 2 years.
Oh, absolutely.
We've seen it happen in Canada and also in the United States where, and for sure in South America, where if a stock gets too cheap, the Chinese will just come in and buy it.
That was happening with Arch Coal and BTU here. It was happening with Vale in South America and with some of the big Canadian mining companies, too.
Oh, it happened with Teck Camino after they got overextended buying Fording coal about 2 years ago.
Mm-hmm.
So the answer to your question is yes, the Chinese purchases of raw materials are an ongoing story. It's one that's not going to change, and it provides a good avenue to invest in China, even for people who may not yet know enough about China to be comfortable about it. Of course, what we would tell them is you're going to make more money actually buying in China, and so you need to get familiar with it and get comfortable with it sooner rather than later.
Is China a friend or an enemy of the United States? How should the United States be conducting its foreign policy vis-a-vis China?
Well, I don't think that China is a military enemy of the United States. They certainly are an economic competitor. There's no question about that. And that's a situation that's not going to change.
Mm-hmm.
The Chinese are coming from third world status to first world status, and they're doing it fairly quickly. And so the reality with the Chinese is that they're going to have their own version of the Monroe Doctrine, just like we had in the United States when we became a world economic power. But I don't see the Chinese having any particular aspirations to take over the world like the Soviets did in the 1950s and 60s.
Okay, Jim, I got to take a station break here. This is John Thomas, the Mad Hedge Fund Trader. Reminding you that you can subscribe to my daily investment newsletter for only $179 a quarter by visiting my website at www.madhedgefundtrader.com. There you will find my last 2.5 years of research. for free. You can also find archives of my past shows with other investment heavyweights. I'll be right back with Jim Trippin of China Stock Digest right after this break. This is John Thomas, the Mad Hedge Fund Trader, back with my guest today, Jim Trippin of the China Stock Digest. Jim, I understand you're a bit of a scripophilist.
That is correct.
Tell me what you have. People used to call me a scripophilist, and I would go, what? Thinking it was some sort of arrestable crime. What are the highlights of your collection?
Well, like yourself, I collect historic financial documents, and some of the things that I've managed to get over the years is I've got the original stock for the Titanic, which was actually owned through a series of trusts by J.P. Morgan. I have the original Standard Oil Trust signed by Rockefeller when he created Standard Oil.
Oh, that's nice.
I've got some original war bonds from the American Revolution signed by some of the signers to the Declaration of Independence.
Wow.
Gosh, I've got the stocks and bonds that built the Panama Canal. I've got just very, very interesting things in the collection.
Let me tell you what I've been able to pick up over the years. When I first went to China in the early 70s, they hadn't seen any foreigners for 25 years. Everyone had Japanese war occupation money they issued in China, which they tried to sell. They were trying to get rid of this Japanese money, which, of course, was worthless. But I bought some for a few cents and have never wanted to own a paper currency since then. I originally got into it by visiting a thrift shop in Anchorage, Alaska, and they had up on the wall one of the original share certificates for the Trans-Siberian Railroad.
How interesting.
And I bought that for $5. And one day I was sort of hiking around the base of the Golden Gate Bridge, found an abandoned office, went in there, opened a file cabinet, and it was full of canceled bonds issued for the construction of the Golden Gate Bridge. A lot of those in absolutely perfect condition. So, they look nice on my wall. That's all I can say.
That's right.
Some of the bonds are rapidly catching up with the value of the frames.
That's great.
Talk about individual stocks. What are your top stock picks in China right now? And throw the symbols in there while you're at it.
Sure. So one of the stocks that we like right now in China is China Medical, which trades in the symbol CMED.
Okay, so that's Charlie Mike Echo Delta, CMED.
Correct. And the reason we like it is it's a medical equipment manufacturer. And right now the Chinese government's on a big kick to improve healthcare in the more rural areas of the country. These are the areas where the people have the lowest incomes and they have limited access to healthcare. And so one of the beneficiaries of that new spending program is, of course, the medical equipment manufacturer, CMED, being amongst them. And you can pick up the company right now for a fairly reasonable valuation. As far as forward earnings, we're estimating, or the consensus estimates are that it's trading at somewhere in the neighborhood of 8 times forward earnings.
Eight times. Okay, keep them coming. I have a whole portfolio to fill up here.
Oh, gosh, wow. Okay, so another one that I would take a look at right now would be Mindray Medical. And Mindray is a second medical equipment manufacturer in China that trades under the symbol MR. And its 52-week range has been from 26 to 40, and it's in the low 30s right now.
So Mindray is Mike Romeo.
Correct. Correct. And another beneficiary of the same general trend.
Mm-hmm.
If you look at the areas of the Chinese economy that have not done well over the last year, one of the main areas that has not done well has been foreign export. And so we've stayed away from companies that are overly sensitive to that trade. And one company that we like that is not sensitive at all to that is the largest cell phone company in the world called China Mobile. And I'm a customer of China Mobile. I use them every time I go to mainland China, and trades under the symbol CHL.
CHL, so that's Charlie Hotel Lima?
Correct. And what we like about that stock is that the Chinese were very smart about a lot of things they've done in their move to capitalism. One of the things that they've done is they've not wasted time and money by building a huge infrastructure of wired telephone lines. They just leapfrogged it to go straight to cellular. And the China...
straight to cell phones.
Oh, absolutely. Well, the thing about China Mobile is they have more customers than we have population in the United States.
Right. It's like 600, 800 million, something incredible.
Just an unbelievable amount of customer base. They will have the prime position in the marketplace, and there's no way a foreign competitor is going to come in there and take it away from them because the Chinese government wouldn't let them. And so one of the keys with investing in China is realizing that the Chinese government tends to have policies that favor their home team, and if you want to make money in China, you have to play with the home team. But
exactly.
That's okay. They let you.
Yeah, Japan had the same problem.
Yep. And I'm sure that it will have to change over time because their foreign competitors will make them change it over time. But
yeah,
for the time being, that's the way it is.
That's what happened in Japan, is that the Japanese were terrified of foreign companies coming in and taking over their companies. So they made inward flows of capital very difficult, and then when they finally eliminated the restraints, the market crashed and no one cared anymore.
Right. Well, it's not a situation where you can't get foreign capital in there, but when you try and directly compete with their what they call their national champions, they do make your life difficult. So it's easy enough just to buy their stock and you're fine.
Okay. Any other names?
Well, on the energy side, I like PetroChina, which is PTR.
Right. That's Papa Tango Romeo, PTR.
And the story there is that you have just a small percentage of the population that can afford cars now, and it's already the world's largest new car market. And as they continue to grow economically, as they continue to develop, more and more people will want to be just like us and have those cars.
So China doesn't really have any oil of its own, so I guess the margin, the angle here is that they would import oil and then sell it for a decent profit margin.
That's correct. And they have some. They have a very limited amount of onshore production, and they have a fair amount of offshore production, but it's just truly a drop in the bucket to their national needs.
Yeah, they just don't have the geology. No salt domes. They're not like Texas or Saudi Arabia.
Nope. So that's why we like the company, because those Chinese auto drivers are going to have to get the oil someplace. And they're going to have to get it from PetroChina or from Sinopec, which would be the other one I would look at.
Okay. Tell me, do you ever get nervous doing research in China about safety issues? Because they just arrested another analyst for espionage or treason, something like that, for disclosing the locations of oil wells.
Well, I think that you have to recognize that when you go to a foreign country, you're going to have to abide by their rules and you're going to have to play by their rules. That's something that Google, didn't really pay attention to, and so they're paying the price for it right now. But in China, when you remember that roughly, all of the companies 30 years ago were government owned, and still today the majority of the blue chip companies are at least partially government owned. Anytime you're doing research on that company, arguably you could be accused of doing espionage. So you have to be very transparent about what you're asking. You have to be very upfront, and you don't disclose anything they tell you not to disclose.
Yeah, it's a careful path you have to tread. I know when I was a journalist, people were getting locked up in Asia all the time. Anyway, it's been a fascinating hour, Jim. I'd like to bring you on again sometime in the future. This is John Thomas, the Mad Hedge Fund Trader, thanking you for joining me today and reminding you that you can subscribe to my daily investment newsletter for only $179 a quarter by visiting my website at www.madhedgefundtrader.com. Thank you for joining me today, and good morning.